Welcome to Critical Readings, episode 43, for the 29th of June, 2020. I'm Dr. Cooper, and today with me I have a slightly reduced panel, because our good friend Jack Tyler is currently on a plane whistling through the air at the absurd rate of speed of like 650 knots or something. But the rest of us are sanely on the ground, with our feet firmly planted, and the rest of us includes Clinton Hollister.
Hello, it's good to be back.
And Mr. Keen.
Glad to be here again.
His first name I've forgotten.
Drew.
It's not Dutton, is it?
It's Drew.
Drew, excuse me. I'm sorry. I just drew a blank. I'm looking at this D, and I'm like, D, D, D. What is D? David. Not Dirk. No one is named Dirk anymore. Bring back Dirk. All right. Well, we have a bouquet of delights for you today from the second part of Book 2 of Spencer's Fairy Queen. The representative selections to help you understand what's happening in this great English literary epic. But before we can get to any of that, we need to know the story so far. And for that, we turn to Drew Keen.
Just very briefly, because we have a lot to cover tonight. When we left Guyon, he was navigating on the Idle Lake, and he was being pursued by the wizard Archimago, and he's left his guide, Palmer, behind, Palmer the Pilgrim, and he finds himself now entering into a cave, which is where we pick up in Canto 7.
Excellent. Well, our first representative sample comes in Canto 7 of Book 2 at stanzas 11 to 13, where we have... Well, actually, why don't we let someone else read? Drew, would you like to read those three stanzas for us?
Sure.
Starting at "Vainglorious Elf," said he.
Yes, "Vainglorious Elf," said he. "Dost not thou weet that money can thy wants at will supply, shields, steeds, and arms, and all things for thee meet? It can purvey in twinkling of an eye, and crowns and kingdoms to thee multiply. Do not I kings create, and throw the crown sometimes to him that low in dust doth lie, and him that reigned into his room thrust down, and whom I lust do heap with glory and renown. All otherwise," said he, "I riches read, and deem them root of all disquietness, first got with guile, and then preserved with dread, and after spent with pride and lavishness, leaving behind them grief and heaviness. Infinite mischiefs of them do arise, strife and debate, bloodshed and bitterness, outrageous wrong and hellish covetise, that noble heart as great dishonor doth despise." So here we have an exchange between Mammon and Guyon. Mammon is, of course, the god of wealth, mentioned in the New Testament. And he is trying to deceive Guyon into thinking that worshiping him and therefore pursuing wealth, allegorically speaking, will solve all of his problems. And Guyon is not deceived. He recognizes that from money is the root of all disquietness, which is a verse translation of 1 Timothy 6:10, where the love of money is described as the root of all evil. So like Christ in his temptation in the wilderness, Guyon is able to answer the fiend with scripture, which is a double-edged sword, the word of God.
Well, thank you for that. It's a really excellent reading. And we can see here, I think, the references to Timothy. They're pretty explicit, right? This is not not intended to be glossed over, especially when we consider this as a work that's meant to form people in virtue. Here's one of those virtues that's very, very obvious in the course of the text.
Indeed. Now, my question that I had at this point when I was reading was, will Guyon face all of the deadly sins at some point?
That's quite fun, right? In a way.
Right, yes. We have avarice here. Just before that, we had him on the river or the sea of idleness. Mm-hmm. So that's two.
Sloth, yeah.
So I wonder if the others are coming.
Well, should we spoil it for our listeners? Will the remainder of the sins be discovered in book two?
The only one that I'm not sure is there is gluttony, but I may not have just noticed it. But I've checked off all of the others.
Excellent. Well, let's keep our eyes open as we go along. Maybe we can discover gluttony hiding somewhere.
So what do you think? Who's had the best deceits, the best temptations so far?
Mammon doesn't seem to work at all for Guyon. So he's pretty able to overcome all the arguments that Mammon presents to him. But the interesting thing about this is this whole canto is a debate. Mm-hmm. Mammon tries to reason with him that devoting yourself to the pursuit of wealth would be the best course. And Guyon keeps answering with scripture and sounder reasoning, looking very much like a Christ figure as he faces this temptation.
Do you think it's because he's so committed to the chivalric virtues and they contradict this sort of materialistic outlook? Or what do you think it is that's equipping him?
I think that's a very good question, and I think it's answered in stanza 33, because Guyon there tells Mammon that he has his eyes on another better bliss, and therefore he's not willing to become a slave to riches.
Okay.
And so this is not...
It's more of an eternal versus temporal thing.
Precisely. This is just like Boethius in The Consolation of Philosophy. It's not the renouncing of pleasure and good. It's actually the pursuit of eternal pleasure and good. So he's got his eye on a higher good, and therefore these ephemeral goods like money are not sufficient.
Moth and rust will destroy.
Precisely. And we do get lots of references to that, because the gold and all is all covered with spider webs and marred somewhat. He keeps going through the cave.
I've just had a thought.
What's that, Cooper?
What about excess in Canto 12?
That's the gluttony, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because she offers him food and drink, right?
Yeah, wine.
There it is. They're all there.
Yeah, all the there. Seven. They need to be. This is the book on temperance, really. So, you know, the seven deadly sins are going to
temptations.
Going to be defeated by temperance. I think something you've just said a moment ago is, I think, a little provocative to me, which is that you say that Mammon, in some ways, is not at all successful, perhaps the comparatively less successful than other temptations. And I think how different that is from the world as we find it, right, where Mammon is sort of Mammon triumphant.
Reign supreme.
Yeah, the supreme, right? What is Gounod, right, for us to hear in his Faust, Le Vaudor est toujours debout, right? Calf of gold is still standing.
Yes.
It reigns supreme over the people, right? All fall down to worship it. And here we have Mammon being almost easily rebuffed with simple direction to the scriptures, which I suppose is a reminder for us that although Mammon seems to reign everywhere at all times in all places to the absolute limit and extremity, it can be defeated, and not with great difficulty either. It's a strange temptation because it's most of us have enough without, you know, needing to sell out, as it were, to Mammon. And yet the desire for more, maybe there's gluttony, right, is what really leads people into that. I'm reminded of that.
In kind of like the question of what is the good life right now? I mean, you know, worldly success that you find through either high renown in the world or through a large amount of money in your bank account.
Yeah.
So I think that goes back to what Drew was saying about if you believe in the eternal, then this could be a relatively easy temptation to overcome. But if you don't, I mean, what else is there, right? So,
and I think that Guyon's insistence that he has his eyes on a better pleasure than this offers is important, because if you try to fight the allure of temptations by just being stoic,
yes,
then I think you put yourself into a weak position.
Right.
Because eventually your will is going to give out.
And exactly.
Pleasure is more
pleasurable than nothing. Sure. Right? So you've got to have your
well, everything is more pleasurable than nothing, right?
Indeed.
Exactly. We had the Feast of St. Thomas More this week. Remember the quote from A Man for All Seasons? It profit a man nothing to give his soul for the whole world, but for whales? To Richard Rich, right? Who got whales out of the bargain for his perjury. We get far less than whales these days, and people will sink to even greater lengths than mere perjury. So it certainly seems to be the case that mammon is triumphant. And without religion, without true religion there, I think, to reinforce you, the sort of secular stoicism, which is offered as a sort of alternative, right? Like that, like that's the humanitarian bent is towards, I know a lot of atheists who read Marcus Aurelius and Epictetus and so on and so forth. And that's not going to help you in the end. It's not going
to. Yes, Spencer's definitely in the Christian Neoplatonist tradition where this is not about the, this is not about the lack of pleasure, but this is a pursuit of a higher pleasure. Mm.
Yes, exactly. Right.
And there seems to be a sort of ladder of ascent toward that higher pleasure as you're being trained on this journey. Right.
Indeed.
One thing I think that we see here is that these are demonic forces, right? That these are powers and principalities that are being leveled against the protagonist. And if he were only on his own, right, if he were adopting a Stoic philosophy where he had to rely upon his own will, why fight that battle single-handed, right, without any assistance, without any truth upon which to fall back, only having the self as defense?
Right, and so here he's turning to Holy Scripture, but he's also been helped by the Palmer or the Pilgrim, and mm-hmm. soon we're going to see your favorite character in literature come
Arthur's
forward.
Gonna appear.
But this is really Guyon's big test, or his first big test, because the Palmer's not here with him.
Right.
So this is the first time we're seeing him on his own, and he's handling it quite well, I think. Now Mammon carries him, or leads him deeper and deeper into the cave and into the very mouth of hell itself. And within hell, he sees all sorts of despicable fiends like revenge, despite, treason, hate, jealousy, fear, sorrow, shame, horror. All of these different figures are depicted. Then he goes into a garden, the garden of Proserpina, the queen of hell. And in the garden are golden apples and a silver stool, which I think we were going to read.
Yes. We are. And that is at Canto 7 at stanza 63, which reads as follows. Infinite Mo, tormented in like pain, he there beheld, too long here to be told. Nay, Mammon, would there let him long remain for terror of the tortures manifold in which the damned souls he did behold, but roughly him bespake. Thou fearful fool, why takest not of that same fruit of gold, nay, sittest down on that same silver stool to rest thy weary person in the shadow cool? All which he did. The next stanza begins. All which he did.
Yes. So the readers of this would have immediately recognized this silver stool. This is taken directly out of classical mythology, where Theseus and Pirithous descend to hell because Pirithous wants to abduct Proserpina, the queen of hell, and he enlists his friend Theseus to help him in that. And when they get there, they are tired and they sit down, and the seat that they sit in traps them, and they're unable to move. And they spend a great deal of time stuck in hell until Hercules, who descends in one of his labors, sees them and attempts to free both of them. He's successful in freeing Theseus, but he's unable to free Pirithous, who got his just deserts for trying to abduct the queen of hell. And we see lots of figures as we're going through hell here who are being punished in ways that fit the crime. So Tantalus, for instance, is depicted. And in this, we see Spencer doing something very similar to Dante in the Inferno. So this is the part of the epic in which there's a descent into hell, which is a classical epic convention. Not in every epic, but in most of the epics, there is a
a descent through hell.
So several scholars have pointed out that the first reference here is probably to Tantalus. And the second, a little less clear, according to, was it Anthony Spearing who did this? No, A.C. Hamilton. A.C. Hamilton, who points out the second is probably a reference, a little less clear, to Pilate. Tantalus, of course, who seeks to eat the fruit but cannot, and Pilate, who cannot rest. And so here we have these two sort of references to the damned in hell. And there's other readings. It says here that Alpers interprets both as temptations, as appeal to the lust of the flesh. S says explicitly at 64.8, and less persuasively, Kermode interprets both as an appeal to blasphemous curiosity, which I think is rather general. But definitely, Tantalus should spring to mind. Pilate, I missed that, and I'll have to...
Well, Pilate's actually explicitly described in a previous stanza.
Yeah.
He's attempting to wash his hands, as he does in the biblical story, washing his hands from the guilt of Christ's death. But here he washes himself and he's only ever more and more dirty.
Yeah.
The more he washes, the more dirty he is.
The principle here is like that he's sort of engaged in a sort of Sisyphean task and he can't rest. And that's why the stool is there, right? So that it's a little unclear. So I can see the point there, but, that's interesting.
And the real danger is if he would sit on this stool, because I think that the point is that he would not be able to get back up. This is Mammon's final attempt to trick him, because he leaves after this. So if we can just get him to sit down, then he would have him trapped there forever. It's also interesting.
That's Upton's interpretation, the forbidden seat of the goddess Ceres, right?
Yes, precisely. Now, Milton picks up on this in his mask Comus. Mm. Comus is a young maiden who goes into hell, and she is debating with a fiend named Comus. And he has her trapped in an enchanted chair from which she cannot move until an angel comes and rescues her. And I think that Milton very likely had this passage in mind. He was a great lover of Spenser.
Well, this this all goes rather poorly for Guion, right? But Mammon brings him back to the surface, and he persists and is not overcome. It's not a pleasant experience, but he doesn't yield. And Mammon brings him back, and the fresh air is so shocking to him after this cave-like delving that he swoons. And that takes us to Canto 8.
Yes,
and Palmer's
indeed.
Back.
Palmer shows back up, and there's also someone else here with the sleeping guy on.
So here we have the guardian angel who is going to accompany Palmer, or accompany Guion, right? That's where Palmer finds him. Guion is with the angel. And we get a little description of that in a few stanzas here at 5 and 6, which read, and here's the description of the angel. Beside his head there sate a fair young man of wondrous beauty and of freshest years, whose tender bud to blossom new began and flourish fair about his equal peers. His snowy front curled with golden hairs, like Phoebus' face adorned with sunny rays, divinely shone, and two sharp winged shares, decked with diverse plumes like painted lays, were fixed at his back to cut his airy ways. Like as Cupido on Idaean hill, when having laid his cruel bow away, and mortal arrows wherewith he doth fill the world with murderous spoils and bloody prey, with his fair mother he him deeds to pay, and with his goodly sisters, grasses three, the goddess pleased with his wanton play, suffers herself through sleep beguiled to be, the whilst the other ladies mind their merry glee. Okay. So here we have this angel. He's even got the stereotypical wings on his back to help him cut his way through the air. Is this sort of picturesque description of an angel?
Indeed, yes.
It's a very Milton, of course, will do the same thing, right? And the Gustave Doré pictures certainly drive that home. So what are we to derive from this, that these that this angel is here protecting Gaion and Palmer?
Well, I think at least that while we might have thought that Gaion was alone, he in fact hasn't been. So in the immediately preceding canto, he's facing Mammon alone. Palmer's not there, and then at the end of it, he's so overwhelmed that he swoons. And when he wakes up, we see, or before he wakes up, while he's lying there, when Palmer comes back up to find him, Palmer finds that he's being guarded by this angel. And so even though we might have thought that Gaion was alone, those who are pursuing virtue are actually being aided by spiritual powers as much as they're being tempted by spiritual powers.
That is an important reminder, right? Lest someone draw the wrong lesson from book or from Canto 7, that one can be self-sufficient and succeed. Spencer is reminding us, no, actually, he's not alone. He's being assisted. Self-sufficiency is not enough.
This is right. Not a Pelagian epic.
Certainly not. And think about when he's bringing up those scripture passages to counter Mammon, the Holy Spirit is prompting him. So he has aid from his guardian angel, from the Holy Spirit. So he's definitely not pulling this off solo, even if Palmer is absent.
So then the angel sees Palmer's back and leaves Gaion to the Palmer's care and flies off. And then we have Archimago, Pyrocles, and Simocles show back up again to cause more trouble. But all through this, Gaion is sleeping. Arthur happens to be coming by, just coincidentally, or perhaps providentially. And the Palmer calls him over and enlists him to help protect Gaion. And Arthur is able to then fight against Pyrocles and Simocles.
And we have that right here at near the end of Canto 8 at 51 and 52. I'm sorry, I'm jumping ahead. This is when grace is offered and refused. I take that back. So this is what will happen. So after Arthur defeats Pyrocles and Simocles, we have this this moment, and it's just before Gaion wakes up, and then he'll be friends with Arthur. But full of princely bounty and great mind, the conqueror not cared him to slay. Arthur doesn't want to kill them. But casting wrongs and all revenge behind, more glory thought to give life than decay, and said, Paynim, this is thy dismal day. Yet if thou wilt renounce thy miscreance, then my true liegeman yield thyself for aye. Life will I grant thee for thy valiance, and all thy wrongs will wipe out of my sonnolence. Fool, said the pagan, I thy gift defy. But use thy fortune as it doth befall, and say that I not overcome do die, but in despite of life for death do call. Wroth was the prince, and sorry yet withal, that he so wilfully refused grace. Yet, sith his face so cruelly did fall, his shining helmet he gan soon unlace, and left his headless body bleeding all the place. So, One thing I like about this little section here is we don't actually see, in terms like descriptively, the coup de grace, right? It's a kind of a wonderful actual pun in a sense, because you know, this grace is being refused, right? And so you know, you have the coup de grace instead. But yes, what we have is we have what comes before it and what comes after it, right? You unlace the helmet so that you can cut his head off, and then left his headless body. Like, it happened in between those two lines. You just don't, you never actually see Arthur shed blood. It just, we see what comes before and what comes after. It's an interesting effort to protect him, right, from any hint of wrath or malice, because he certainly doesn't want to do it. And Spencer is keen to point that out.
There's no gratuitous gore in Spencer.
No. Well, thinking back to book one, where we have some rather monstrous image, like things, you know,
oh, yeah, right,
bursting open, right? And,
yeah. Oh, well, fair enough.
Yeah, there's a little bit.
So I think it's fascinating here, too, though, that this is kind of a really interesting question. So you have two warriors. In theory, you'd think, right, they're better off if they have a certain confidence or fierceness in battle. And so the fact that Arthur, he's been victorious, yet he doesn't come out of this battle with sort of pride or wrath, but instead he maintains this Christian humility and this graciousness in victory that you see contrasting with Pyrocles' pride in defeat, right? So you get the suggestion here that if he would have won, he would have been wrathful and prideful. But even when he's defeated, he doesn't humble himself, but he's wrathful and prideful. And so I guess we were talking about kind of lost virtues when it came to the triumph of Mammon. And I think this idea of being humble and gracious in victory is another virtue that is lost or foreign to our society. What do you make of that, Cooper?
Yeah, right. That this is a part of the trope of romance generally, right? That this is a chivalric conduct. That and chivalric conduct is modeled, at least in the romance, right? It's modeled on certain Christian virtues. It's predominantly a Christian activity, although we do see that there are examples of non-Christian knights. I can't remember his name. I'm thinking of Pyrocles because it also begins with a P in Le Morte d'Arthur, right? There's a Moor knight who's just as chivalrous, right, even though he's not Christian. So, but that's the exception rather than the rule. And I think that humility plays a big role in that. The prowess is very important. It's probably the predominant virtue, which basically means strength in combat. There's more to it than that, but effectively strength in combat. It's a martial virtue. But not significantly less important than prowess is humility in defeat and magnanimity towards the defeated. And Arthur is displaying half of that here, right? He's displaying the magnanimity. And what we would expect of someone who has been justly defeated in a fair fight, if that person is chivalric, he would accept his defeat and say, yes, you have overcome me. And even if I will not accept the grace of being let off, I will admit that you are the better knight and you have won this day. But that doesn't happen. In fact, Pyrocles denies that he was overcome, right? And says, say that I not overcome do die in the third line of stanza 52, right? That's patently false. I mean, Arthur defeated him. Fairly.
Right.
So like, you haven't beaten me is this sort of rejection of reality. It's a lie. It displays the very pride that is the cause of his defeat.
We'll call it fake news now.
Yeah, exactly. there's a very Monty Python-esque moment, you know, here, sort of like, you know, 'tis but a scratch, right? I'm not defeated. Your arm's off. No, it's not. I'm fine. But, right? But it's not meant to be funny, because what we're supposed to derive from this is like, look, this person is so filled with pride. First, pride is the reason he was defeated, but even his defeat is insufficient to check his pride. And even his impending death isn't sufficient to dissuade him. He's going to double down, right? I'm not defeated. You have to kill me. And then he is killed. Like, wouldn't it, if reason prevailed, just mere reason, not necessarily some sort of virtue, just mere reason prevailed, surely he would admit reality to preserve his own life, right? But no.
Right.
Pride he prevents it.
This high view of himself more than the truth, more than his own life even.
And that's how pride works.
Milton Satan does this as well.
This is how pride works.
Yep.
It forces you to deny reality in order to maintain it. And I would suggest that if you look around you, if you've seen the news of the day, you will see plenty of pride, right? Where people are denying things that are patently true, because to do otherwise, they would have to admit that they were wrong. Right? This is what pride does. And look what it leads to here. It leads to his totally unnecessary death, and it's a vain death. It's a vanity.
So the other really interesting thing about this Akanto to me is that Gaion's asleep the whole time, and this is our hero. This is the night on which this entire book is focused, and he's sleeping. He needs
well,
to help.
It is 35,000 lines long. He does need a little break now and again. Let's give him a rest.
But I think the larger point, though, is that temperance requires help. Yeah. Last week, our other panelist, Jack, said that this is not not something to be faced alone. You need a team. And so he has a team. He has an angel. He has Palmer. And now he has Arthur. And even while he's sleeping, he's being helped.
I think that what we see here is a reminder that not only can we not do it alone, but we cannot hold out indefinitely forever on the front line. It's okay to step back, take a breath. Not only okay, it's necessary, right? That there needs to be some kind of source of rejuvenation to help us regain the strength that we need to, again, weather these sorts of temptations. And for many of us today, we might say, well, this is similar to like the sacrifice of the Mass, right? Or the spiritual life of prayer, that we can find in Gaion's rest some sort of analog to the things that help us to recover our strength in order to face the temptations and difficulties of ordinary life.
And we see this as a contrast to the idleness that we talked about last week. So this is Sabbath. That was idleness. The idleness led to other kinds of sins, but the Sabbath, the rest, actually leads to strength. So they might look similar on the surface, but they're quite distinct.
Right. So I've known people who have wanted to, their aspiration in life is to only work a part-time job because they think that will be a more fulfilling life, you know, a more minimal life or whatever.
What are you going to fill the time with? That's what will determine whether it's fulfilling or not. If you fill it with self-indulgence, you will find it strangely unfulfilling, right?
Right. But if you fill it with making podcasts.
Yes. Exactly. Then it's very fulfilling indeed.
Yes.
It's not particularly profitable, but you know what? I don't need whales, so I'm all right.
Right. There you, well, listeners, I think Cooper has a Patreon associated with
I don't. I don't. It's all free.
It's free all free.
If there's some absolutely mad billionaire out there who wants to cut me a check, get in touch. There'll be a lot more podcasts if I'm independently wealthy. All right, let's see. We have
Gaion wakes up. He sees the dead bodies of Pyrocles and Simocles, and he meets Arthur. They become friends, and they learn about one another's separate quests. And then Gaion and Arthur proceed together to find a place of rest, which takes us into Canto 9.
And we're going to get a really great description in Canto 9 of man's potential, as it were, which is kind of a theme for the book, as Drew has rightly pointed out. And it reads, "Of all God's works, which do this world adorn, there is no one more fair and excellent than is man's body, both for power and form, whilst it is kept in sober government. But none than it, more foul and indecent, distempered through misrule and passion's base, it grows a monster, and incontinent doth lose his dignity and native grace. Behold, who list both one and other in this place."
I think this stanza is basically a key for interpreting the entire book. So last week we talked briefly about the Platonic idea of the soul having three parts, reason, will, and appetite, and that a healthy soul will have a hierarchical relationship between those three: reason ruling, will obeying, appetite subdued, but that the soul can be inverted, where appetite takes the lead, the will serves the appetite, and reason is subdued. And in that case, something happens to the man. So man in this Neoplatonic Christian universe is in a middle place within a great chain of being. And you've read Paradise Lost here, so I'm sure you've talked about the chain of being already. Because of man's middle place being both spiritual and animal, he has the potential to either ascend into a spiritual existence, which would require that properly ordered soul where reason and spirit are associated, so that reason is governing will and appetite, or to descend to a beastly nature, the spirit then being subdued, the image of God in man being subdued. And this is depicted in man's very physical form, as this stanza indicates. Cicero, in his Laws, said, "Man stands upright, unlike the other animals who crawl with their heads towards the ground. Man stands upright with his head towards the sky, looking at his true home, whereas the animals that crawl look towards the ground at their true home. But a man who is dominated by appetite becomes like a beast, oriented towards the ground, and descends rather than ascending towards his true home in the celestial spheres." So this tells us exactly what Guyon's real test is and what the test of temperance is. Will you ascend or will you descend?
And another way that Spencer seems to be framing it is, will you govern yourself, right? Mm-hmm. So this idea of self-government seems critical, not, you know, follow your appetites, follow your
base gut passions,
but instead the like you're talking about, these rational faculties, these habits need to be cultivated that will allow you to govern yourself.
Which is why precisely this is brought up in Cicero's Laws, right? Cicero's not talking about man's physical form looking toward the skies in a book on the laws because it's irrelevant to social structure. It's extremely relevant to social structure, because the more man governs himself and lives by reason, then the more stable and healthy the civil society can be.
And the less powerful the centralized state needs to be
precisely
to maintain order. So when man ceases to govern himself, if you want order, you're going to need a very strong external force to govern him.
Right, because a man that's descending becomes like a monster. Monsters are dangerous to everyone.
Right.
And they need to be restrained. So the more that man descends into his appetites, the more he needs external restraint to make everyone safe.
Well, we see that that's, I mean, literally, that's on the page, right? It's not, there's a difference between temperance and distemper, right?
Right.
The lack of temperance.
Right.
Right. Temperance is self-government.
Right. And who wants to be around somebody who can't, you know, control their temper, right?
Yeah.
Like Pyrocles. Yeah. Yeah. As fiery as Pyrocles.
Right.
Who can't accept grace.
Shall we move forward? We get a little history lesson in book in Canto 10.
Just to get us up to the history lesson, Arthur and Guyon are proceeding to a castle that they can see in the distance. And as they approach it, they request to be let in. And the guards on the wall tell them, "No, we can't let you in because our castle is being besieged. And it's been besieged for 7 years. And it's dangerous. And run, run, run." And rather than run, our two heroes fight the besieging army, which is like described as a swarm of gnats. And after they drive off this swarm of gnats, then they are let into the castle and they learn its name. It is called the House of Temperance, and it is ruled over by a lady named Alma. Alma is Latin for benevolent or nourishing or kindly, like alma mater, your benevolent mother. And so she's sort of an image of Diana, the Virgin Mary, this very figure of temperance. So as she's guiding her guests, Arthur and Guyon, through her castle, they come upon a room in which there are a great many books, and they discover two books that seem to pique their interest. One is a history of the kings of Britain, and one is a history of the kings of Fairyland, which takes us into Count of Ten.
And Arthur, being a literate man, wants to read the book. And in the books, he finds all sorts of kings. And if you've read Geoffrey of Monmouth, then you will know what's contained in there, that Arthur's own history is written in Geoffrey of Monmouth, but also all those kings from, well, from Troy, really, which was the imagined origin of Britain, all the way up to to and through Arthur to his successors. And Arthur reads it, but it ends at Uther Pendragon, which is his father. So he doesn't get to see his own future, as it were. But Guyon reads a history of Faerie. Now, one of the interesting things in Arthur's reading is that this is sort of, I don't know if it's terribly important to the Faerie Queen, but it's an interesting little story if you're familiar with Shakespeare or several other works, that Lear makes an appearance. And if you've read or seen Shakespeare's King Lear, then you'll know all about him. And we have a little sequence here that describes Spenser. This is writing before Shakespeare, is describing the story of King Lear as he understands it. And this is at stanza 27 in Canto 10, and it says, "Next him," that is after Leal, "next him, King Lear, in happy peace long reigned, but had no issue male him to succeed, but three fair daughters, which were well uptrained in all that seemed fit for kingly seed, amongst whom his realm he equally decreed to have divided, though in feeble age, nigh to his utmost date he saw proceed. He called his daughters, and with speeches sage inquired which of them most did love her parentage. The eldest, Goneril, gan to protest that she much more than her own life him loved, and Regan greater love to him professed than all the world, whenever it were proved. But Cordile said she loved him as behooved, whose simple answer, wanting colors fair, to paint it forth, him to displeasance moved, that in his crown he counted her no hair, but twixt the other twain his kingdom whole did share. So weddeth one to Maglin, king of Scots, and t'other to the king of Cambria. Twixt them shared his realm by equal lots, but without dower the wise Cordelia was sent to Aganip of Celtica. Their aged sire, thus eased of his crown, a private life led in Albania, with Goneril long had in great renown, that naught him grieved to been from rule deposed down. The wretched man gan then advise too late that love is not where most it is professed. Too truly tried in his extremest state, at last resolved likewise to prove the rest, he to Cordelia himself addressed, who with entire affection him received. As for her sire and her king, her seemed best. After all, an army strong she leaved to war on those which him had of his realm bereaved. So to his crown she him restored again, in which he died, made ripe for death by eld. And after wild, it should to her remain, who peaceably the same long time did weld, and all men's hearts in due obedience held, that till that her sister's children woken strong, through proud ambition against her rebelled, and overcome, kept in prison long, till weary of that wretched life, herself she hung." Well, that's rather unpleasant. But
quite a different ending than Shakespeare's, because in Shakespeare, Lear dies almost inexplicably at the end, perhaps because Shakespeare thought that a tragedy has to end in the death of the protagonist. But here, he's restored to his crown and dies a happy king, thanks to the temperate Cordelia.
But then, of course, poor Cordelia has to suffer for Lear's raising up briefly of his other two daughters because they rebel and overcome her. So
right, there's still consequences for his poor judgment.
The sins of the father
visited on his faithful daughter, right? Which I can see Shakespeare kind of. If he had read that version, I could see him kind of being revolted by it, right? That shouldn't Lear suffer for his lack of wisdom? Why should Cordelia suffer?
Perhaps that's an explanation for his ending.
Yeah. Well, there we go. a nice little, historical footnote.
The longest episode in this book. So it goes through this genealogy of British legendary British kings, but this is the one where it zeroes in on the most. So it must be relevant to the overall theme of the book, temperance.
Okay, let us proceed to Canto 11. Just a little comment I'd like to make here. This is primarily a battle, but there's an interesting little comment I'd like to point out, which is that it stands a 30, and again it stands a 33. We have references to Arthur as a Briton. This is Geoffrey of Monmouth's description of him. It's the general consensus that if there's a very big if there is some sort of germ of truth that is the origin of the Arthurian myth, then that person was probably a Roman Briton, right? We wish to stress if very strongly, because there's a great deal of doubt about that. This is very different, a very different time than when Geoffrey of Monmouth was writing it. So Spencer is writing this in Elizabethan England, where the idea of being British and being a Briton, while not quite like it would be after the Act of Union, it's sort of proto-nationalism, right? Elizabeth summons some of this herself in her famous speech, right? That about the I think it was the Dutch, right? That Spain and Parma and so on and so forth, right? So we can see
the stomach and the heart of a king, and I a king of England too.
Exactly, right? So there is a king of England, right? And this is sort of the beginning. We see this beginning of a sort of proto-British nationalism here. It's not fully formed, but keeping in mind that the point I'm making here is that Britain here is a unifying thing for the reader. It's a reminder of Arthur's similarity to the English of his day. Whereas for Geoffrey of Monmouth, calling Arthur a Briton would have been a reminder of his difference, right? Because for the readers of the 10th, 11th, 12th century, Britain meant the people who lived in, you know, the Roman Britons who occupied Britain into the 5th, 6th, 7th century, right? And after that, disappear into Celtica, as it were. This is, I think, an important point for us when we're thinking about Arthur here, is to see this as that transition point where Britain and British starts to become connected to ideas of Arthur as Englishness or as an English Isles sort of thing, rather than a sort of Romano-British construction. Okay.
And of course, one of the reasons that the Tudors had to cultivate this idea of a British identity was because they were Welsh rather than English. So this is really important for their political regime.
Yeah, Henry Tudor's grandfather was a servant, right? He was not royal in any sense, and it's only the accident of battle that puts Henry VII, Henry Tudor, on the throne when he defeats Richard III at Bosworth Field. So this sort of Britanno-nationalism is understandable from the position, especially from the Welsh, right, where the Britons did kind of survive, right? It's one of those Celtic diaspora things where the Britons kind of persist and assimilate into the rest of society, where they don't really do that to the same extent in what we would call England, right? Angle land, where the Angles and the Saxons later kind of push them out or breed them out. Okay, Canto 12. Guyon's in trouble. It was going all so well, right? They were reading some books. They were taking a little bit of ease in the House of Temperance. But then things go badly. At 65 and 66, Guyon is almost overcome. As that fair star, the messenger of Morna, his dewy face out of the sea doth rear, whereas the Cyprian goddess newly born of Thocian's fruitful froth did first appear. Such seemed they. And so their yellow hair, crystalline humor, dropped down apace. Whom, such when Guyon saw, he drew him near. and somewhat gan relent his earnest place. His stubborn breast gan secret pleasance to embrace. The wanton maidens him espying stood, gazing a while at his unwonted guise. Then Thwan herself low ducked in the flood, abashed that her stranger did a vice. But Thother rather higher did arise, and her two lily paps aloft displayed, and all that might his melting heart entice to her delights she unto him bewrayed. The rest hid underneath him more desirous made. Oh my! Oh my!
Just to get us where we are, this is after Gaion has left the House of Temperance.
Yes, this is not happening in the House of Temperance, that's for sure.
Arthur stays behind and defends the House of Temperance against the invading army that's come back. Gaion and Palmer have a quest to finish. So all the way back in Canto 1, Akrasia and the Bower of Bliss were introduced, and Gaion committed himself to destroying the Bower of Bliss. Well, now he's actually made it to the Bower of Bliss, and so there's again a navigation on the water. And he, you know, navigates his way between the Gulf of Greed and the Rock of Reproach, which somewhat echoes of Scylla and Charybdis, mm-hmm. and finds his way to the Bower. And as they are walking through, there are many different sites of sensual delight depicted. And one of the things that Spencer does remarkably well is allows the reader to feel something of the temptation that Gaion feels through his luscious descriptions of the Bower of Bliss. And this is perhaps one of the more luscious passages in which Gaion is almost taken in through his wandering gaze. And the Palmer has to actually rebuke him and jerk him back onto course so that he's not taken in by these women.
And everything is on display here, right? We have a very significant difference, because here everything is temptation, everything is desire, everything. There's no restraint, right? Like they're just showing her bare breast to him, just deliberately attempting to entice him. We are as far from the Castle of Temperance as we could possibly be.
Yes.
So how is Gaion going to respond to this? Is he going to be defeated? Is he going to give up on his quest and repose here in the Bower?
We shall see.
Well, at 74 to 76, there's a song. And here's what it says. The while someone did chaunt this lovely lay, ah, see who so fair thing dost fain to see, in springing flower the image of the day. Ah, see the virgin rose, how sweetly she doth first peep forth with bashful modesty, that fair seems, the less ye see her may. Lo, see soon after how more bold and free her bared bosom she doth broad display. Lo, see soon after how she fades and falls away. So patheth in the passing of a day of mortal life the leaf, the bud, the flower, nay more doth flourish after first decay that erst was sought to deck both bed and bower of many a lady and many a paramour. Gather therefore the rose whilst yet is prime. Sounds like George Herbert, doesn't it? For soon it comes age that will her pride deflore. Gather the rose of love whilest yet is time, whilest loving thou mayest loved be with equal crime. He ceased, and then gan all the choir of Burtis their diverse notes to attune unto his lay, as in approvance of his pleasing words. The constant pair heard all that he did say, yet swerved not, but kept their forward way. Through many covert groves and thickets close, in which they creeping did at last display that wanton lady with her lover loose, whose sleepy head she in her lap did soft dispose. Well, here we have this this song that basically is saying, give in, right? Life is short. It's very much in the tradition of the Cavalier the poets here, the Carpe Diem poem.
Yes, and this is actually the original from which all of those "gather ye rosebuds while ye may" type poems originate. This is translated directly out of Tasso's Italian epic, Jerusalem Liberata, which had been written just a few years before Spenser began writing The Faerie Queene, and had a massive influence on him, especially in this canto right here. The Bower of Bliss is closely modeled on Tasso's Garden of Armida. Armida is an enchantress, just like Acrasia is. And this enchantress figure has a long lineage. Armida, Acrasia, the other Italian epic poet Ariosto, in his epic Orlando Furioso, has Alcina, who's also an enchantress figure just like this one, who entices men through physical delight, appeal to their appetites, appeal to their sexual impulses. And this goes all the way back to Homer in the Odyssey, where Ulysses meets Circe. Circe, this enchantress who transforms all of his crew into swine. And it's only because Minerva, the goddess of wisdom, through Mercury, gives Ulysses a special plant, a molly plant, that he's also able to escape Circe's enchantment and free his men. So all of these enchantress women are descended from Homer's Circe, and they turn men into, not necessarily always swine, but they turn men into beasts, which is precisely what we saw in Canto 9, that man has the potential to become. Man has the potential to ascend godlike or to descend to the bestial. And by giving in to appetite, which these enchantresses want them to do, they become beasts. They become brute animals.
Now, lest anyone think that Spenser is merely cribbing from Tasso, something quite unique is going on here. And if you are familiar with the Carpe Diem poem, the Seize the Day poem, right? Gather rosebuds while ye may, by Herbert. Or if you've read Corinna's Gone A-Maying, the same author. Or if you've read Marvell, right, to his coy mistress, right? Mm-hmm. Then you will be familiar with this. But they have a fountainhead here. And here's what the analysis says here. That this, although this is a brilliant imitation of the birdsong in Tasso, while it follows Tasso closely, it is wholly original. It is the definitive expression of a commonplace. Carpe florem, right? Gather those rosebuds, seize the flower, seize the bud. And it references here Leishman, 1961, Quinones, 1972. And it's important to note that the answer to it is given by the Faerie Queene's single speech in the entire poem, which is reported mm-hmm. by Arthur at Book 1, Canto 9, 14. Arthur reports that the Faerie Queene says, "Dearly sure her love was to me bent, as when just time expired should appear." Right? So that it's not all about youth, actually. Just time expired, right? The appropriate, that love should endure and be there, the appropriate, for the appropriate length of time, not just a dalliance of a moment, which is what the inhabitants of the bower are whispering, right?
And so this requires the same kind of insight that we saw from Guyon in Canto 7, where he recognizes that there's a difference between ephemeral pleasures and permanent pleasures. Mm-hmm. And he's keeping his eye squarely focused on what lasts rather than what won't last.
And therefore, he's going to be triumphant. And we'll see that right here at stanzas 83 to 86. And here's what happens to this bower of bliss. "But all those pleasant bowers and palace brave, Guyon broke down with rigor pitiless. Nay, aught their goodly workmanship might save them from the tempest of his wrathfulness. But that their bliss he turned to balefulness. Their groves he felled, their gardens did deface, their arbors spoil, their cabinets suppress, their banquet houses burnt, their buildings race, and of the fairest late now made the foulest place. Then led they her away, and eke that night they with him led, both sorrowful and sad. The way they came, the same returned they reeked, till they arrived where they lately had charmed those wild beasts that raged with fury mad, which now awaking, fierce at them gan fly, as in their mistress rescue whom they lad, but them the palmer soon did pacify. Then Guyon asked, what meant those beasts which there did lie. Said he, "These seeming beasts are men indeed, whom this enchantress hath transformed thus, while all her lovers, which her lusts did feed, now turned into figures hideous, according to their mindes like monstrous. Sad end," quoth he, "of life intemperate, and mournful meed of joys delicious. But Palmer, if it mote thee so aggrate, let them returned be unto their former state." Straightway he with his virtuous staff then strook, and straight of beasts a comely man became. Yet being men, they did unmanly look, and stared ghastly, some for inward shame, and some for wrath, to see their captive dame. But one above the rest in special, that had an hog been late, heeked Grilla by name, repined greatly, and did him miscall, that had from hoggish form him brought in to natural. Said Gion, "See the mind of beastly man, that hath so soon forgot the excellence of his creation when he life began, that now he chooseth, with vile difference, to be a beast, and lack intelligence." To whom the palmer thus, "The donghill kind delights in filth and foul incontinence. Let Grill be Grill, and have his hoggish mind, but let us depart, whilst weather serves and wind."
Isn't that marvelous?
Let Grill be Grill.
So Grill, by the way, is taken from Plutarch's Moralia, where he has, among many other episodes, a dialogue between Ulysses and a recalcitrant crew member who insists on remaining a hog. Grillus is his name in Plutarch because it's Latin. And they have a discussion about whether it's better to be a man or an animal. And Grillus insists that it's better to be an animal.
Well, he's going to try to remain one, right? Like he's going to repine like a hog and be like a hog.
Spencer interprets that with the reference to scripture. He says there's that proverb in scripture about a dog returning to its vomit.
Yeah, exactly, right. And that's what's going to happen here. He's just going to go back. Let Grill be himself, a hog.
Well, and what's so fascinating about that is the contrast, right? If we read those poems about gathering flowers while we may, and if you read the sensual description of the temptress, it appears extremely alluring and seductive, right? And so the notion that this is actually vomit, if the scales come off your eyes, is quite shocking.
And we still call men who are given in to their appetites too much pigs.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So this literalizes that.
There's several Bible references mentioned here. Revelation 22:11, "He which is filthy, let him be filthy still." 2 Peter 2:22, "It is come unto them according to the true proverb, the sow that was washed is returned to the wallowing in the mire." But it also points out that Spencer may have been influenced by the homely moral, "as swine are to gardens," etc., because it is used, for example, on the title page of Sidney's Arcadia, 1593. So there you go. So you'd been familiar with this. And is perhaps encoding it himself here at the end of book two with Grill, who will go back to his hoggish ways. Well, thus endeth book two, the book of temperance, as it were. And next week we'll begin our essay on book three, right? And we will make our way through it in two parts, as we have done. And I believe it is also 12 cantos. Yes. Yep.
Yes.
So we'll be doing six and six once again. So if you've been with us so far, we're what, a third of the way through six books. This is the end of book two. So I think we're making good progress.
Indeed.
I'll be sad when it's all over, actually, because it's been quite fun. It's not about temperance, but next time it's going to be about chastity. So that's book three, the book on chastity. So we've had holiness, we've had temperance, next chastity. And then friendship, justice.
Bower of Bliss is a good hinge point, good transition to a book on chastity.
Yeah. Oh, indeed, yes.
Right? To end the Bower of Bliss and then to march into chastity. Well, hopefully you've enjoyed this. And if you have, please do feel free to leave a comment on academician.com on this podcast post. You can type your comment there. No registration is necessary. You just type it in and your comment will show right up on the page and we'll get it. You can also send us a tweet at Crit Readings on Twitter and that will work as well. And we do ask again that if you're listening to this on iTunes, please do leave us a positive review. Something like, Crit Readings is simply the best podcast there is, full stop. 5 stars. If you'd like to offer less than 5 stars, that's nice, but please don't. We only want 5-star reviews. We're very picky about this. And tell your friends, too. If you know people, if you know people who want to learn more about literature or who are interested in poetry or who perhaps were your, if you were an English major, you know some of your old classmates, feel free to please share and enjoy. We want everyone to have the chance to listen to Crit Readings. All right. As usual, all that remains now is for me to thank my panelists. This week it was Drew Keene.
Bye, everyone.
And Clinton Collister.
It's been a pleasure.
And I'm Dr. Cooper, and we're done for another week, but we'll be back next week with the beginning of Book 3 of Spenser's Faerie Queen. Until then, from all of us here, Godspeed.